hunter-gatherer life as solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. This chapter looks at the truth behind these differing opinions and considers the impact of microbes on the lives of individuals and the population as a whole. As the name suggests, hunter-gatherers are nomads who live in small groups or bands, constantly occupied by the pursuit of food. They move with the seasons, following herds and crop cycles, hunting, trapping, fishing, and gathering wild fruits, roots, leaves, and seeds. This was man's routine occupation for thousands of years before it was almost completely replaced by the agricultural revolution that began some 10,000 years ago. However, a few hunter-gatherer tribes still survive in remote pockets of the world, or at least did so within living memory. With no first-hand written accounts of the ancient hunter-gatherer way of life, writing was only invented around 3000 BC, we must reconstruct it as best we can with information gleaned from their settlements, cave dwellings, burial sites, and skeletal remains. The few hunter-gatherer tribes that still survive today, like the Australian Aborigines, the Kalahari San people, the African Bushmen, and the Pygmies of the African rainforests, also provide some useful information. But as none of these tribes is entirely free from contact with the outside world, study of their microbes must be interpreted with caution. A promising new line of inquiry involves the use of molecular genetic probes to pick up microbe-specific DNA or RNA sequences in human remains. And although these techniques are still being developed, they are already proving to be highly sensitive tools for gaining new insights into the ancient history of microbes and pinpointing when and where they first infected humans. A typical hunter-gatherer band contained 30 to 50 people, generally a few extended family groups, and formed part of a loose network of bands that would meet from time to time, perhaps to celebrate a marriage or bury their dead, when members would take the opportunity to exchange information. Each band had a defined territory, and the size of the band was dictated by the availability of food in their particular patch. On average, hunter-gatherers required around 1 square mile of foraging area per person, so the number of people in a band was critical. Past a certain tipping point, further increase would be self-defeating, since it would mean travelling further for food, and with no form of transport, carrying heavier loads back to their settlement. So every now and then, a growing band would split in two, with half moving to a new territory. Hunter-gatherer bands were small enough for social and political structures to be simple and informal, most business being conducted on a personal level. And since virtually everyone was engaged in gathering and preparing food, all had the same rights to resources. There was little need for social class distinctions, and the society was generally mutually supportive. But implicit in the hunter-gatherer lifestyle are regular moves from one settlement to another, every few days, weeks, or months, depending on the availability of food in the foraging area. So, although this lifestyle suited fit adults, there was little support for the sick, elderly, and infirm, and archaeological remains suggest that they were sometimes abandoned. Similarly, large young families would have hindered the mobility of the band, and there is evidence that infanticide was commonly practiced to control family size, giving an average gap between children in a family of 4 years. Generally, hunter-gatherers seem to have been reasonably healthy. In both modern and ancient bands, members were generally lean and fit, and although they probably experienced occasional food shortages, on the whole, they were adequately nourished. Their life expectancy was around 25 to 30 years, with infant mortality between 150 to 250 per 1,000 births. These figures may seem high when compared to present-day values in the West. Infant mortality in Western societies is 3 to 10 per thousand, and a life expectancy is over 70 years. But they compare favorably with values from any time in history up to the 18th or 19th century, and are almost equivalent to the lowest life expectancy and highest infant mortality figures from developing countries today. Skeletal remains clearly show that hunter-gatherers did not generally die of starvation, dietary deficiencies, or injury, but unfortunately, bones on their own are not very useful for providing evidence of infectious diseases, since microbes do not generally leave fossil evidence of their presence. Only the few microbes that attack bones and joints, such as those causing tuberculosis, syphilis, and leprosy, can be diagnosed with any certainty, and none of these was common among ancient hunting bands. Despite this lack of evidence, many experts believe that infectious diseases were among the commonest causes of death in hunter-gatherers, but the nature of these diseases can only be guessed at by using our knowledge of present-day infections and the insight into their origins afforded by modern molecular techniques. Today, microbes use almost every conceivable transmission route to bridge the gap between susceptible hosts, but many of these routes were barred to microbes during the hunter-gatherer era because of the small size, isolation, and mobility of the bands. It is thought that the airborne microbes that cause the classic acute childhood epidemics of modern times did not exist in Paleolithic times. Once seeded into a band, these microbes would have ripped through its members with no trouble at all, but the sparse population of small bands, which only met up occasionally and probably foraged in areas many days' walk apart, would have prevented further spread. So microbes would soon run out of susceptible people and be unable to maintain their vital chains of infection. Indeed, studies on acute infections like measles, mumps, and whooping cough in relatively isolated modern South American tribes show exactly this pattern. When one of these microbes reaches a band from the outside world, it sweeps through its members but fails to spread to all bands in the region and cannot gain a permanent foothold. However, the more recent observation of the devastating effects the acute childhood infections had on isolated American Indian hunter-gatherers when introduced by European explorers in the 15th century is probably the most compelling evidence we have to suggest that these microbes had not infected them before. They had not evolved resistance through previous encounters, and they died in their thousands. See Chapter 5. Of all the acute childhood infections, chickenpox is the rare exception in that it almost certainly did infect hunter-gatherers. The causative virus, Varicella zoster, is a member of the ancient herpes virus group that humans inherited from their ape-like ancestors. These viruses, which also include the cold sore and genital herpes viruses, are carried by people in all the world's most remote tribes and are so well adapted to humans that they are virtually never life-threatening. They have overcome the problem of spreading among people in sparsely populated areas by dodging immune attack and setting up an association that lasts a lifetime. This silent infection reactivates intermittently, as recurrent cold sores, for example, to produce new viruses which ensure their survival. So although chickenpox behaves like a classical acute childhood infection, once the acute illness is over, the microbe hides in the host's nerve cells and can reappear years later to cause a bout of shingles. This nasty skin rash consists of tiny blisters filled with viruses ready to spark a chickenpox epidemic among a new generation of susceptible children. Contamination of food and water with human sewage is a highly successful transmission route for many microbes, particularly where standards of hygiene are low. but since hunter-gatherers collected and ate their rations on a daily basis and had no facilities for storing either food or water, fecal contamination is unlikely to have been a major problem. Many of the large parasitic worms common in Africa today are transmitted by this route and cause anemia from chronic intestinal bleeding. The resulting lethargy could have serious consequences for a hunter-gatherer band, but since effective transmission only occurs with a build-up of fecal material containing parasite cysts and eggs, their frequent moves, abandoning their waste materials along with their camps, probably protected them from heavy worm infestations. The same argument applies to microbes that rely on vectors, such as rats, lice, and fleas, to ferry them between hosts, and those that require an intermediate host, such as the parasite that causes schistosomiasis and that needs to infect a water snail to complete its life cycle, see Chapter 3, because these would also be left behind in an abandoned campsite. Malaria. So far, it seems that hunter-gatherers conveniently avoided many of the microbes which plagued later humans, but microbes with flying vectors could perhaps have increased their range sufficiently to overcome the problem of the sparse population. The commonest of these diseases today is malaria, which infects 300 to 500 million people every year and kills over a million. And since Africa is the presumed original homeland of humans and is the continent worst affected by malaria today, it has long been assumed that malaria was a scourge of early humans. There is certainly evidence of malaria infection in Egyptian mummies dating from 3000 BC, see Chapter 3, and the disease is clearly described in the Chinese Nei Ching, the Canon of Medicine, written in 2700 BC, but there are no records dating back as far as Paleolithic times. So although the disease is undoubtedly ancient, exactly how ancient is presently unknown. Previously called the ague, a diminutive of the Latin febris acuta, meaning acute fever, the name malaria, mal-aria, or bad air, was popularized by the Italians in the 19th century to describe the disease which had plagued their country for centuries. Because it was most common among people who lived and worked in the Pontine marshes and Roman Campagna during the summer months, it was generally believed to be caused by bad air or miasma rising out of the swamps. Malaria can appear in many different guises, depending on the type of parasite and the age and level of immunity of the victim. In its acute form, in the non-immune host, the parasite begins by causing a flu-like illness, which settles into a characteristic cyclical pattern. As each paroxysm begins, the body temperature climbs precipitously, and yet sufferers feel severely chilled. With teeth-chattering rigors and uncontrollable shivering, they curl up, miserably clutching at blankets for warmth. When the fever peaks at 39 to 41.5 degrees centigrade, the exhausted patient breaks out in a profuse sweat and the temperature falls. Symptoms of drowsiness, delirium, seizures, or coma indicate the onset of cerebral malaria caused by sludging of parasitized red blood cells in the blood vessels of the brain. This is invariably fatal if untreated and is the commonest cause of death in the acute phase of the disease. In cases with no brain involvement, fever attacks continue for weeks or months, but gradually resolve as immunity develops. The type of malaria parasite infection determines the periodicity of the paroxysms, which occur every 48, tertian fever, or 72, quartan fever, hours. And some parasites can set up chronic infections, which relapse at intervals for many years. In areas of intense malaria transmission, young children are the worst affected, as immunity to malaria builds up slowly and does not completely protect against attacks until they are 4 to 5 years old. that although slow to accumulate, immunity is rapidly lost without constant contact with the parasite. So anyone who leaves and then returns to an endemic area, as hunter-gatherers might have done in their wanderings, is liable to severe attacks. Similarly, in areas where malaria is epidemic, arriving with the rains and disappearing in the dry season, people of all ages suffer severe bouts of the disease at the beginning of the rainy season. Nowadays, the overall death rate from malaria is around 1%, but this can reach 30% in severe epidemics among the non-immune. Today, a million or so children die from malaria each year, but among hunter-gatherers, the death of a young child was less of a threat to the survival of the band than the loss of an active adult. After all, children were not involved in collecting or preparing food and could be more quickly replaced than adults. So it was the burden imposed by chronic malaria in adults that would be the most arduous for hunter-gatherers. As the prefect of Girgenti in Sicily wrote of the disease in his country in 1908, "The enormous prevalence of the disease has the most serious social consequences because the infection, tenacious and lasting, undermines the body. Malaria causes physical decline. It prevents growth, and it alters the very structure of the population. Fever destroys the capacity to work, annihilates energy, and renders a people sluggish and indifferent. Inevitably, therefore, malaria stunts productivity, wealth, and well-being." This long-term debility, affecting both the victim and the community as a whole, if widespread, would certainly have endangered the viability of hunter-gatherer bands. Malaria is caused by a protozoan called Plasmodium, the name derived from the Greek meaning a matrix containing many nuclei, a parasite with a complex life cycle in two hosts, an asexual phase in its primary vertebrate host and a sexual phase in its mosquito vector. The parasite probably evolved from a once free-living pond protozoan that had adapted to parasitize the aquatic larva of a flying insect. Over the course of time, this protozoan developed its two-host life cycle, parasitizing both the blood-sucking insect as well as its victims. The Plasmodium that causes malaria in humans was first identified in 1880 by Charles-Louis Alphonse Lavrin, a French army doctor who was working in Algiers, when he noticed some unusual cells in the blood of soldiers suffering from malaria. These cells contained a strange dark pigment, and as he watched them under the microscope, some literally swelled up and burst, releasing a dozen or so tiny microbes with furiously lashing flagella. Lavrin was sure that these were the cause of malaria, but just a year before, some influential Italian doctors had identified a bacterium, Bacillus malariae, that they claimed was the cause. So his report was greeted with some skepticism. However, in the end, he managed to convince a group of parasitologists in Rome of the seriousness of his claim, and by 1884, they too had identified parasites in the blood of malaria victims. Very soon, the different types of Plasmodium were linked to the 2- and 3-day parasite life cycles, and the significance of the periodicity of the fever attacks, which coincide with the release of new parasites from infected red blood cells, was finally understood. Another 20 years passed before a British doctor, Ronald Ross, serving in the Indian Medical Service, clarified the microbe's complicated life cycle. His interest in the transmission of the malaria parasite was sparked by a visit to Sir Patrick Manson in London, a distinguished pioneer of tropical medicine, who, while working in China, made the astounding discovery that the filarial worm that causes elephantiasis is carried by mosquitoes. He encouraged Ross to look for the malaria parasite in mosquitoes, and so Ross spent the next 3 years in Bangalore and Secunderabad trying to find Plasmodia in mosquitoes fed on malaria blood. He knew little about the different mosquito species, but was finally rewarded by seeing the parasites in the stomach of mosquitoes he called dapple-winged, and in 1897 he reported his findings in the British Medical Journal in a paper entitled "On Some Peculiar Pigmented Cells Found in Two Mosquitoes Fed on Malaria Blood." But before he could unravel the whole of the parasite's life cycle, the army transferred him to Calcutta, where his studies were held up by a lack of malaria cases. In frustration, he turned to studying malaria in birds and soon sorted out the mosquito transmission route. He found that the parasites reproduce sexually in the stomach of the mosquito vector and then move to its salivary gland, where they are poised ready for injection into the mosquito's next victim. Once the various steps of the bird malaria cycle were unraveled, the human parasite life cycle was quickly found to be similar, but it was Professor Giovanni Battista Grassi, working at the University of Rome, who fitted the final piece of the complex puzzle in place when he identified the female Anopheles mosquito as the vector for human malaria. At the time, rivalry between these researchers was intense, and no one is sure how much Grassi's contribution was influenced by Ross's work. Obviously, the Nobel Prize Committee thought it was, since both Laveran and Ross received Nobel Prizes for their work, but Grassi did not. There are nearly 400 named species of Anopheles mosquito, of which 45 are important malaria vectors, and the conditions that these insects require to breed determine the global distribution of the parasite. Only the female mosquito can transmit malaria because only she sucks blood, requiring it to fuel egg production. Once she has ingested Plasmodia from her victim, it takes around 2 weeks before the parasite cycle in her stomach is complete, so she must survive at least this long after feeding in order to transmit the parasite. Suitable ambient temperature and humidity are essential. Malaria transmission does not occur at temperatures below 16 degrees centigrade or above 30 degrees centigrade. All mosquitoes need access to water at the larva stage, but it is their species-specific behavior patterns that determine whether or not they transmit malaria. Anopheles A. gambii is the major malaria vector in Africa today and is highly adapted to its task of spreading the microbe. It is long-lived, has a particular liking for human blood, and lives in and around human dwellings, breeding in the stagnant water of wells and puddles. In areas where malaria is particularly rife, parasite-laden A. gambii may deliver around 1,000 bites per person every year. With the help of this highly specialized mobile injecting machine, the malaria parasite might have threatened small traveling bands of hunter-gatherers in Paleolithic times, but although it is not known for sure when the close association between A. gambii and humans began, it was probably not until the dawn of agriculture in Africa around 5,000 years ago. Experts think that by clearing the forest for planting crops, humans stimulated a population explosion among Anopheles mosquitoes that had previously lived in the occasional sunspot in the forest created by a fallen tree. When humans started living in fixed agricultural communities with relatively dense populations, these mosquitoes could at last live entirely off humans, breed in the inevitable standing water in and around their settlements, and evolve their present-day habits. Today, the Plasmodium species infects all major groups of land vertebrates, with its most ancient forms, thought to be the descendants of dinosaur malaria parasites, now infecting birds and reptiles. All other malaria parasites, including those in primates, have probably evolved from this species, diverging some 130 million years ago. So our ape-like ancestors probably carried primitive malaria parasites, but most experts agree that the malaria parasites we recognize today first rose to prominence in sub-Saharan Africa, and from there spread throughout Africa, across the Mediterranean, overland to Asia and Europe, and, much later, crossed the Atlantic with human migrants to the Americas. See Chapter 5. Their spread to each new area was preceded by the migration of blood-sucking Anopheles mosquitoes that have existed in Africa since ancient times, well before the evolution of humans. But the question of when present-day malaria parasites evolved in humans is still hotly disputed. Of the 25 species of Plasmodium that parasitize primates, only 4 infect humans: P. falciparum, Vivax, Malariae, and Ovale, which probably evolved separately in other animal species. Infection with P. malariae, Ovale, or Vivax is rarely fatal, but these parasites can set up chronic infections. P. ovale and Vivax can hide in the liver and reappear at intervals for 2 to 3 years after infection, and P. malariae can cause a lifetime of relapsing illness. P. falciparum, on the other hand, cannot set up a chronic infection, but it causes the most severe disease and is responsible for almost all malaria deaths today. This is by far the commonest type in Africa today, so what could its impact have been on early hunter-gatherer bands? Surprisingly, despite its virulence, P. falciparum is not easily transmitted between humans. Its intense transmission in Africa is almost entirely dependent on A. gambiae because of the insect's preference for biting humans, and although the parasite maintains a presence in Papua New Guinea, Melanesia, Haiti, and a few hotspots in South America, the vectors in these regions are far less efficient. Most evidence points to a West African origin for present-day P. falciparum, but scientists are still trying to pinpoint exactly when this occurred. They have analyzed the DNA sequence of genes from parasites of humans and other species to determine how closely related they are. Using the molecular clock technique, which makes the assumption that the more genetic differences between the parasite species, the longer they have evolved separately, they find that P. falciparum is most closely related to the chimpanzee malaria parasite, P. reichenaui, and estimate that the two species diverged 4 to 10 million years ago. This date conveniently overlaps with the proposed date of divergence of hominids from chimps, suggesting that both inherited the parasite from their common primate ancestor. If this is correct, then an ancestral form of P. falciparum must have infected our hunter-gatherer ancestors in Paleolithic times. But most experts do not think that modern-day P. falciparum could have survived in humans with the inefficient mosquito vectors that were around at the time, particularly among the sparse population of hunter-gatherer bands. Scientists are now struggling to identify when today's P. falciparum first emerged in humans by measuring the length of time to its most recent common ancestor, that is, the parasite from which all others evolved. Again, they are using the molecular clock to assess genetic divergence, this time between P. falciparum strains from different parts of the world. But the results are conflicting. Some groups find a population bottleneck as recently as 5,000 to 10,000 years ago, suggesting that the current global P. falciparum population arose from a very small number, theoretically a single strain, at that time. This led scientists to propose the malaria's Eve hypothesis, relating the beginnings of modern-day P. falciparum infection to the change from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle to slash-and-burn agriculture that occurred in Africa around that time, and that would have coincided with evolution of the mosquito vector A. gambiae, critical for efficient transmission of P. falciparum. These scientists also argue that this relatively short coexistence between man and parasite accounts for the virulence of P. falciparum and estimate 5,000 to 10,000 years of coexistence to be sufficient for malaria-resistant genes like thalassemia and sickle cell anemia to reach their present levels in malaria-exposed populations. See Chapter 1. In contrast, using the same molecular techniques, other researchers find a much more genetically diverse P. falciparum population that suggests the parasite has a far longer history in humans, dating the transfer to around 100,000 to 180,000 years ago. They argue that the virulence of P. falciparum is not because it is a relatively new human pathogen, but because, as discussed in Chapter 1, a debilitated host is advantageous for parasite transmission. But the question of whether P. falciparum could have maintained its human-to-human transmission in the sparse hunter-gatherer bands of 100,000 years ago still remains unanswered. The molecular genetic techniques used in both these studies, although powerful, are relatively new and not without problems. There are several reasons why results from separate research groups may not agree, particularly as the two groups analyze different sets of parasite genes and their P. falciparum isolates came from different parts of the world. Also, the assumption that the rate of change in parasite DNA is constant over time is only correct if the genes examined are not subject to selection pressure, which might induce rapid change. Since P. falciparum has two hosts, mosquitoes and humans, and is under constant pressure to evolve ways of counteracting the immune system of both, this assumption may not be correct. Clearly, only analysis of more genes and further P. falciparum isolates can resolve the issue of when this parasite took hold in the human population, although, on balance, it seems unlikely that modern-day P. falciparum could have survived in sparse hunter-gatherer bands without the help of A. gambiae as its vector. However, before drawing any firm conclusions about malaria in hunter-gatherers, we must briefly consider the other types of human malaria. P. vivax, which is the most widespread of the three non-falciparum human malaria parasites, has an interesting history. This parasite is most closely related to P. cynomolgii, which infects monkeys in South and Southeast Asia. This does not mean that human infection arose in Asia, as the two strains diverged 2 to 3 million years ago, at a time when their ancestral hosts were probably widely spread throughout tropical and subtropical regions. In fact, there is good indirect evidence that modern-day P. vivax was restricted to Africa until fairly recently, perhaps around 15,000 years ago, only spreading further afield as the global temperature rose at the end of the last ice age. Evidence for this comes from genetic studies showing that 97% of people from West and Central Africa are negative for a blood group called Duffy, whereas in the rest of the world, virtually everyone is positive. The Duffy protein is an essential cell receptor for P. vivax, and without it, the parasite cannot infect red blood cells. Consequently, today, P. vivax infection is very rare in West and Central Africa. The Duffy negative mutation is harmless, but only homozygotes with two mutated genes are resistant to P. vivax. When the mutation first arose, the chance of one mutation carrying person mating with another to produce homozygous Duffy negative offspring must have been vanishingly small. And even when this did occur, the effect would be diluted again when most of the next generation inevitably took Duffy positive mates. Clearly, it must have taken a very long time and a very strong selection pressure for the Duffy negative mutation to reach its present high level in Africa. So we must conclude that P. vivax has been around in Africa since ancient times and had a major negative influence on human survival. Although it is not possible to pinpoint exactly when P. vivax first affected humans, since Duffy negative people are confined to Africa, it seems fair to assume that it evolved in its present form after the major human migrations out of Africa, certainly no earlier than 100,000 years ago. And using a similar argument, since the Duffy negative mutation is not found in other areas of the world where P. vivax has infected people for around 5,000 years, the parasite must have been in Africa for longer than this. So, given that P. vivax can establish a chronic infection in humans and is therefore not dependent on a constant chain of transmissions, it could have presented a problem to Paleolithic hunter-gatherers in Africa. But perhaps the most likely candidate for infecting hunter-gatherers is P. malariae, a parasite that also infects chimpanzees in West Africa. Unlike P. ovale, which cannot survive outside the tropics, P. malariae can spread in temperate as well as tropical and subtropical regions. And since this parasite can live in its host for a lifetime, it is certainly the best adapted for survival in sparse, mobile hunter-gatherer bands. However, the question of whether malaria really caused major problems to hunter-gatherer bands still remains unanswered, and evidence from modern African hunter-gatherers is of little help. Pygmy tribes have a low rate of malaria, but this is because of their high incidence of the sickle cell gene, which tells us that they have battled with P. falciparum for at least 5,000 years. In contrast, the San, or Bushman, hunter-gatherer tribes living around the Kalahari Desert in South Africa and Botswana lack any evidence of genetic resistance to malaria, and those who hunt in malaria-endemic areas suffer badly from the disease. But it is difficult to relate this information to ancient hunter-gatherer bands living at a time when the efficient A. gambiae vector did not exist. On balance, it seems likely that some form of malaria probably caused by P. malariae and or P. vivax affected the lives of Paleolithic humans. And although these parasites are not generally lethal, the severe lethargy caused by chronic infection would certainly have endangered the survival of hunter-gatherer bands, which needed all their adult members to actively forage for food. However, it is clear that malaria did not reach its present-day levels in Africa until the agricultural revolution provided the ideal conditions for a highly efficient mosquito vector to evolve, allowing microbes to flourish. As soon as humans began to hunt big game on the grasslands of East Africa, they entered a new environment that was populated by huge herds of wild animals and the parasites they carry, and some of these unfamiliar microbes took the opportunity to jump species and infect man. Hunters engaged in killing, butchering, and eating wild animals must have been exposed to all kinds of new zoonotic infections, sometimes with severe or fatal consequences. The rabies virus, for example, generally completes its life cycle in wild animals such as foxes, wolves, and bats, but if hunters were bitten by a rabid animal, then the resulting encephalitis would be fatal. Butchering wild game was equally hazardous, as the bacteria that causes tetanus, botulism, and gas gangrene, all universally fatal, live naturally in animals' intestines. Similarly, eating raw or poorly cooked meat leads to the risk of ingesting the eggs of parasites like the tapeworm. Indeed, even today, Inuit bands hunting in the Arctic Circle, where they eat a highly carnivorous diet, have a particularly high burden of these parasitic worms. However, each of these zoonotic infections is only acquired directly from their natural host and does not spread between humans. So although they must have infected individuals within a community from time to time, perhaps even the most active hunters, they are unlikely to have had a profound effect on the life of the band as a whole. But microbes, like the trypanosome that primarily resides in an animal host and has a flying vector, the tsetse fly, could have posed a major threat to the health of hunter-gatherer bands in Africa. Sleeping sickness, trypanosomiasis. Although sleeping sickness, human African trypanosomiasis, has probably been endemic in Africa for many centuries, and indeed is reputed to have killed Mansa Djata, the Sultan of Mali, around 1374, the first detailed descriptions date from the early 20th century, when an epidemic of Negro lethargy swept across Central Africa. The disease is still a major problem, with some 30,000 new cases reported annually. Sleeping sickness is caused by a trypanosome, a highly active protozoan that swims in the blood with the aid of an undulating membrane attached along one side and a lashing terminal flagellum. The name derives from the Greek trypanon, meaning borer, and refers to its corkscrew-like appearance. The disease begins in a non-specific way, with fever, headache, enlarged lymph glands, skin rash, and joint pains. But when the microbe invades the brain, it causes the lethargy, drowsiness, and coma that give the disease its name. Sleeping sickness is always fatal without treatment. Most experts think that hunter-gatherers could not have survived long-term in the tsetse fly belt of Central Africa, and that the problems caused by sleeping sickness may have been the impetus for the human migration out of Africa, which preceded the colonization of Europe and Asia some 50,000 to 100,000 years ago. The sleeping sickness trypanosome was first identified in 1902 by Everett Dutton from the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, UK. While working in Gambia, West Africa, he spotted the microbe in the blood of an Englishman with a fever that did not respond to malaria drugs, and called the disease trypanosome fever. At the same time, a serious epidemic of sleeping sickness broke out in Uganda. But no one related this to trypanosome fever, and as the epidemic worsened, the Royal Society of Great Britain sent a sleeping sickness expedition to investigate. In the end, team members could not agree on the cause, although a young Italian bacteriologist, Aldo Castellani, was sure that the bacterium Streptococcus was the culprit. However, members of the Royal Society's Malaria Committee were unconvinced, and the following year, David Bruce and David Nabarro were dispatched to Uganda on the same mission. Bruce, a Scottish Army surgeon, had made his name in 1894 by discovering that Nagana, the Zulu name for low spirits, a wasting disease of cattle which was rife in Africa, was caused by a trypanosome, now called Trypanosoma T. brucei, B. brucei, and transmitted by the tsetse fly, Glossina species pluralis. Bruce and Nabarro soon found trypanosomes in the blood and spinal fluid of sleeping sickness victims and proved that they caused the disease and were transmitted by tsetse flies by successfully replicating the same infectious cycle in monkeys. Meanwhile, Castellani was back in Africa, and this time he also found trypanosomes. But whether this was an entirely independent observation or influenced by Bruce's finding is far from clear. Castellani, of course, maintained the former and claimed the discovery as his own. Bruce rightly guessed that the trypanosome he had found was the same as the one discovered by Dutton in West Africa, but it was named after Bruce, T.B. gabiense, and is now known to cause sleeping sickness throughout West and Central Africa. In 1910, a third parasite, T.B. rhodesiense, which is also spread by the tsetse fly, was discovered in the region that is now Zambia. This parasite causes sleeping sickness in East Africa. These names can be confusing, so to explain, Trypanosoma is a genus of protozoa, which contains the species T. brucei, of which there are three subspecies, T.B. brucei, which causes nagana in cattle, T.B. gabiense, and T.B. rhodesiense, which both cause sleeping sickness in humans. Today, the sleeping sickness belt lies across the centre of Africa, and although the area it covers expands and contracts over time, due to animal movements, human migrations, and climate change, the disease has never taken hold outside Africa. This tight geographical restriction is dictated by the tsetse fly vector, which requires the unique hot and humid conditions of the African tropics for its breeding cycle. The flies, both male and female, generally feed entirely on animal blood, searching out their prey by smell. They will travel for 90 meters up an odor plume to reach their victim, and once they find it, they suck its blood. That their meal may contain trypanosomes, the flies neither know nor care. They feel no ill effects from this extra burden, and they unwittingly allow the parasites to multiply in their gut, ending up in their salivary gland, ready to be injected into the next victim. In ideal conditions, tsetse flies swarm in dense clouds around game herds, so the insect is a highly efficient vector for the trypanosome with an R0 value. The average number of new infections generated by one case, reaching levels as high as 388 among African cattle. Unlike mosquitoes, tsetse flies do not need water for their breeding cycle. The female nurtures a single larva inside her body, feeding it until the final stages of metamorphosis when she deposits it on the ground and it immediately pupates. The mature fly emerges 2 weeks later, eager for its first blood meal. This cycle, taking around 4 weeks to produce just one adult fly, must be completed regularly and efficiently to maintain a critical population density of tsetse flies. The two subtypes of Trypanosoma brucei that cause human disease have distinct geographical locations on either side of the African Rift Valley and have different disease manifestations. In West Africa, T.B. gabiense causes a chronic disease that may take many years to kill the victim, whereas in East Africa, T.B. rhodesiense induces an acute illness which kills in 6 months. Today, the meeting point of the two disease types is in Uganda, where there is T.B. gabiense in the northwest and T.B. rhodesiense in the southeast. Of the three members of the T. brucei family, T.B. brucei infects wild game animals and domestic cattle, but not humans. East African T.B. rhodesiense infects both wild game and humans, and West African T.B. gabiense infects mainly humans. But although all three types look alike, molecular typing shows that the East African T.B. rhodesiense is so closely related to the animal T.B. brucei that it must have evolved from it. Indeed, the difference in a single gene gives T.B. rhodesiense the ability to infect humans. In contrast, the West African T.B. gabiense is quite distinct from the other two. No animal reservoir has been found, and its origin is presently unknown, although recently bush pigs have been proposed as a reservoir. When a blood-sucking tsetse fly ingests TB brucei from a wild animal and injects it into a human, the parasite is immediately killed by contact with human serum. And although the mechanism of this killing is not understood, a single mutation at some time in the past was enough to convert TB brucei into its serum-resistant subtype TB rhodesiense, which infects humans today. These two subtypes of T. brucei can happily coexist in the blood of virtually all wild mammals on the East African plains, from lions to antelopes to hyenas, causing them no problems. But when a tsetse fly transfers these parasites to a human, only the mutated T. B. rhodesiense can take hold. Knowing exactly when this mutation occurred would date the first human infections with TB rhodesiense and tell us for certain whether hunter-gatherers suffered from its effects. But this vital information is presently lacking. Most experts think that the main foci of TB rhodesiense that we see today in East Africa have existed for millennia, and that the parasite infected hunter-gatherer tribes in Africa 50,000 years ago. And since the African Rift Valley is both the site of TB brucei infection in wild game and the ancestral home of humans, the two could have met early in human evolution. At the critical point, some 1.8 million years ago, when hominids moved from the rainforest to the open plains of East Africa and came into contact with herds of large game for the first time, they must have been bitten by trypanosome-carrying tsetse flies. At first, the serum sensitivity of TB brucei protected them from infection, but as our ancestors became skilled big game hunters, so their exposure to tsetse flies and the parasite must have increased, and at some point a chance mutation in TB brucei overcame its serum sensitivity, allowing the new TB rhodesiense to survive in humans. TB rhodesiense has adapted to both animal and insect hosts, causing no disease in either. This life cycle is well-balanced, stable, and ancient, but when humans intrude on the cycle through being bitten by a parasite-laden tsetse fly, they are not so lucky. The parasite has not adapted to this occasional host, hence the disease progresses rapidly and is inevitably fatal. To the west of the Rift Valley, the ancestral trypanosome must have trodden a very different evolutionary path, although the details are far from clear. When hominids were first exploring the open plains in the east, the west remained cloaked in rainforest, and the ancestor of TB gabiense was probably a parasite of forest-dwelling apes. When this parasite first infected hominids or early humans, like TB rhodesiense in the east, it must have caused devastating disease. But then a human-adapted form evolved and dispensed with its animal reservoir so that TB gabiense and its human host could co-evolve to mutual benefit. Consequently, over thousands of years, the parasite lost virulence, and today's sleeping sickness in West Africa is the milder, chronic form of the disease. Since tsetse flies stay close to wild game, in hunter-gatherer bands, the big game hunters would be at greatest risk from the trypanosome. So the strongest, fittest, and the most able hunters in a band were the most likely to be suddenly struck down with sleeping sickness, first becoming lethargic, then comatose, and soon dying of the disease. In a 50-strong hunter-gatherer band with 10 or so fit, healthy hunters, the loss of one or two could perhaps be sustained, but in the sleeping sickness belt of Africa, it is likely that all those in regular contact with infected animals would be attacked by the microbe, leaving the band without any skilled hunters. Then band members could only fall back on trapping small prey and foraging for fruit and vegetables. But with the added problems of supporting the sick and dying, most of whom would have young families to be cared for, and the constant mobility necessary for finding sufficient food, it seems likely that many affected bands would have died out. Given this scenario, the lethal triad of the trypanosome, the tsetse fly, and the sleeping sickness may account for the very slow growth rate of hunter-gatherer bands, which is estimated at only 0.003 to 0.01% per year, and for the eventual diaspora of hunter-gatherer bands out of Africa. In more temperate regions, hunter-gatherers encountered few new killer microbes, and the resident herds of large game provided a ready food supply. So our ancestors entered a relatively healthy period of history with a plentiful food supply and the means to hunt it. But as we shall see in the next chapter, eventually much of the wild game on each continent, with the exception of Africa, became extinct, probably at the hand of human hunters. Indeed, the protection of a few wild game species in Africa may be thanks to the trypanosome, which drove man out of its territory, thereby preserving the animals it silently infects. In the next chapter, we consider the far-reaching consequences of the extinction of wildlife to our ancestors' lifestyle, with the subsequent human burden of infectious diseases. 3. Microbes jump species. By moving out of Africa to colonize Asia and Europe, hunter-gatherers moved away from its lethal microbes to a healthier life, and their population grew. In Eurasia, big game was plentiful, and as hunters became more adept with spears and clubs, it was easy picking. For a time, bands were almost exclusively carnivorous, probably dining off a single kill for a week or more. But this easy life was eventually jeopardized by restriction of their hunting grounds and loss of their prey. When the last ice age began to lose its grip around 20,000 BC, the weather became warmer and drier, and the landscape changed accordingly. Bands saw their traditional hunting grounds progressively eroded as the plains of Africa and Asia slowly dried into deserts, while the spear-throwing and club-wielding skills they had developed for hunting on open ground were less effective in the forests that replaced the grassland in more temperate regions. Around the same time as this climate change came the demise of many of the world's largest animal species. By 12,000 years ago, over 200 species had become extinct, including giants like the woolly mammoth and rhinoceros, saber-toothed tiger, mastodon, and giant bison and sloth, all of which had risen to prominence in the Eurasian and African landscape after dinosaurs died out some 65 million years earlier. Both global warming and epidemic microbes have been blamed for this mass extinction, but although these may have contributed to the disaster, there seems little doubt that human hunters were the main culprit, since the timing of the extinctions on each continent coincided with their arrival. So game animals were severely depleted in Africa by 40,000 BC, and by 20,000 BC they were virtually extinct in Eurasia. But the rate of extinction of these large animals was most dramatic in the Americas. During the last ice age, the sea level was low enough for the Bering Straits to form a temporary land bridge linking Siberia with Alaska, and many Old World megaspecies crossed into the Americas, thriving there until humans followed them around 12,000 BC. Traveling from the north, these bands of nomads, with their increasingly sophisticated hunting skills and ever-growing population, depleted local herds and moved on southwards in search of more. With no previous human contact, herds of large-bodied herbivores made easy prey and were probably the first to go. Once herbivores were in short supply, the food chain for scavengers and carnivores collapsed, and within as short a period as 400 years, an estimated 135 American animal species vanished. This fast-diminishing source of food inevitably led to competition between bands, and most were forced to adopt the omnivorous diet of their ancestors. Archaeological records from the time show that bands now hunted smaller animals, such as rabbits and deer, gathered fruits,